And then I was 17, later part of 17.
Yeah, okay.
And the first speakers that went into a retail business was that year.
Wow. And we're back, episode 32 of Not an Audiophile, season 2. Today we speak to yet again loudspeaker designers. I know, frustrating. We're going to head off in a different direction in the coming episodes with all sorts of different people. Oh, and some more loudspeaker designers. Today, of course, as per the outtake at the start, we speak to Philip Vafiatis, who explains to us all how to start a loudspeaker business in 1978 as a child and then have it still running today. And then to dovetail that, Nick, the new loudspeaker designer at VAF Research, tells us what he's been getting up to improve the breed, so to speak. Now, I would normally say without any further ado, but in fact, we're adding a new segment at the top of the show where I get to sprout on about things that bug me. So that's up next. Are you craving incredible sound? I think we all are. Well, those listening to this podcast. For over 47 years, Len Wallace Audio has been guiding hi-fi enthusiasts on their audio journey. They're not some corporate machine, just a tight-knit crew of audiophiles and entertainment lovers obsessed with great sound. From precision turntables to immersive home theatre systems, they handpick gear that delivers. Stop by the store in Lane Cove, Sydney, Australia, or visit lenwallaceaudio.com. Len Wallace Audio, where your passion finds its sound. So, a new segment in the podcast today. Really, it's just me talking about something that I've heard, seen, or read about in the last, 14 days. And in this particular case, it's someone else's podcast. John Darko interviewing his with his friend Six Moons reviewer Srajan. They now want to go to hi-fi shows and not listen to equipment. We're not listening. If you can invent a hi-fi show that doesn't have music, we're in.
That we have two distinct types of show. One, yes, that's pure B2B. Mm. And one that's purely to consumers, and not have one show try to serve both audiences with their disparate needs.
But if it's B2B and they're still listening,
no,
I'm still out, because it's not really B2B, is it?
No.
It really needs to be get rid of the listening.
Yeah. No, B2B means to me that people that no longer have consumer needs, their needs are to do business.
Yeah, I don't know. Have you given up at that point where you no longer want to listen to hi-fi? Because I'm in the hi-fi business, you know. It's a business-to-business show, B2B show. But I don't want to listen to the stuff. That is the most bizarre, oddball thing I've ever heard. I mean, 99% of the people I know that are in the hi-fi business are in it because they love listening to music. And yeah, a show is not the ideal place to listen to equipment. Duh. But it's still useful and interesting. And as is also mentioned in the same episode, and quite correctly, the two guys, John and Srajan, state that comparing DAX or something like that, of course, is clearly ridiculous at a show, which it is. So I don't completely disagree with what they're saying, but I do wonder how worn out they both are and maybe should be looking for new jobs. If they don't want to go to a hi-fi show and listen to music. So, you know, I thought I'd report on that. You guys have already heard it anyhow, probably. It's a very popular podcast. It's slightly more popular than ours. And look, always a great listen. They're very interesting guys, highly experienced, but perhaps worn out. So, of course, I would like to know, we would all like to know what you think. You can leave comments about any of our podcasts on the YouTube channel, Not an Audiophile Podcast. You can leave comments there for the particular video. And when I say video, of course, it's a video with a still frame, but the audio is playing. You can listen to it there. You can listen to it on your favourite podcasting app, such as, you know, Spotify or a podcast app on the Apple iPhone, etc. But that's where you can leave some comments. I'd love to know. So, what, hi-fi shows without music? That would be better? Or should we continue on the way we are, where we actually turn on and listen to some music through the equipment, because that's what it's designed to do? Oh, and speaking of hi-fi shows, a local one, a StereoNet hi-fi show, the Home Entertainment Expo, I believe it's called, Pullman Hotel, end of August, 29th through to the 31st this year. We'll be there reporting, and you should probably go and have a look. An amazing amount of exhibitors, very impressive, StereoNet.com. So here today we've got Phil Vafiatis on the line from Adelaide, the hot centre of Australia, and Brad Serhan assisting with probing questions. I'm Andrew Hutchison. This is Not an Audio File. Hey, Phil, thanks for your time today and joining us on this podcast.
Oh, it's wonderful. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, that's good to hear. I'm sure you've probably got better things to do, but we really appreciate your time and interested to hear some of the VAF story and how it got started and perhaps why. I mean, clearly you saw a hole in the market or something. Is that, and did VAF start out as a loudspeaker business, or did it kind of meld into it from something else?
Well, no, it was about speakers right from day one.
Okay.
Oddly enough, I wasn't setting up a building, a company. I was making a kit.
Yeah, okay.
And I bought the parts and built it up. And it turned out that it wasn't quite as good as they said it was. So I was on a little kid. I spent $600 and something because I was I had a job doing milk deliveries at about 4:30 a.m. in the mornings. This is before we were able to drive, right? I'm a teenager at that time.
So how are you delivering the milk on your push bike?
Well, no, we had a van. And
you're the runner, so to speak.
I'd be one of the runners, yes.
Yeah, okay.
So the old days, we don't have that now, but
it is going back, yeah.
Yeah. And so I got a bit of money, and the first thing I bought myself was a Hewlett-Packard calculator, which seemed like a science fction thing way back then.
Yeah, I bet it did.
And and the second thing was a speaker. I wanted just to make a speaker. Okay. So one of the electronics magazines had a makeup of it, and I did that. I bought the parts. I bought some special plywoods and things to make the cabinets.
Yeah.
And I had access to a fairly sophisticated lab, so I could get very good accuracy on the winding of the inductors and all of that. Okay. And after I put it all together and stuff, and the people that put that together said that the inductors will be perfect, less than 1% if you follow it up this way. Mm-hmm. They were 20% off.
Okay.
And so I'm a kid. I spent $600 back in the 1970s.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And I'm going, no, that's not right.
The weird thing always with looking back at these things is that even just to measure inductance, how were you doing that? Or you weren't. You had someone else measuring them and telling you they were 20% out. Is that right?
Well, my brother had was working with what was it called before our current
Telecom?
Telecom, that's what it was.
Or yes. PMG prior and, to that, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and we had the access to, or my brother had access to the lab on the weekends.
Oh, okay, wow. And yeah, okay, that would have worked.
And he had permission to use those. So we actually had access to ridiculous amounts of technology.
You certainly did, yes, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And so that's how we could measure what we'd made.
Yeah, right, yeah, okay. And so what do you want to say what the kit was, or do you remember what it was? I mean, at this stage, I guess they're not going to be too litigious. It was 40, 50 years ago. So do you remember what it was, or at least what the speaker design, the gist of it was, like a two-way, 6.5 or something, or what?
A three-way speaker.
Yeah.
12-inch with a 4-inch diameter mid-range and
okay.
a pretty basic tweeter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they were Philips parts, but it wasn't Philips that did the kit.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Not the James Walker that they had. Yeah, the three-way.
A disaster. Some would say. the Philips three-way of 1974, Phil, or?
Look, it was a long time ago, and it wasn't really the thing about audio. It was about the fact that I felt cheated.
Yeah, yes. And, okay.
That was the trigger for wanting to do other things.
Well, $600 was a deposit on a house. So, I mean, seriously, it almost was, wasn't it? I mean, sorry, deposit on a car. I mean, it's a significant amount of money. And so it was not the way the advertising had portrayed it at all as far as the performance you received.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I started thinking about making speakers.
Yeah.
And I did that. I had a friend that was helping out, and we were looking at how to build crossovers,
okay,
how do we do filters and all of that. And then even that seemed difficult because all of the books that were talking about crossovers, well, frankly, they were wrong. And you know, how can you have a perfect 12 different kinds of rollouts, you know, is it first, second, third, whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what we were told, but then I knew that the drivers had different impedance at different frequencies, so I thought, well, obviously the math doesn't work.
Yeah.
And and that's when we started diving in about time domain. And we were right at the beginning of time domain stuff, and I won't say we're the first, but we might have been the first. And there was another Australian company that was doing something at about the same time.
Yes, and funnily enough, in the same state as I remember it.
That's correct. Yes.
So we don't know who was first, although we suspect. Well, we won't say, but
let's just have a bit of a fun.
Sure.
So I'm going to give you a little bit of history.
Far away. And, interested to hear.
You look at the Duntech speakers. It was John Dunleavy that doing that other stuff, yeah. And John had been mucking about with putting felt on the front, and I was doing that as well.
Yeah.
And one of his staff said, Philip, you've got to stop doing that because we've got a patent on that. And I said, what was the patent? And he went, here it is. And I looked at it and said, yeah, you've got this, but I actually sold the first commercial speaker using that 2 weeks before the patent was lodged.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
I don't know enough about patent law to know. So I guess really the patent should not have gone ahead. Is that right? Because there was a product already in the market. Is that how that works?
It was an American. Yeah, there was an American speaker company that was quite famous at the time, and I don't want to get too many people involved, but bottom line is they were pushed to say you can't use that, and they agreed to not do it.
Yeah, okay.
But I didn't try to beat my chest in that. They said that he's passed away, so this is a long time ago. So yep. there's no negativity to this conversation right now. Right. And I told his staff that I won't share it out. And they said, yeah, okay, good. Just please don't tell too many people. That was pretty much it.
Until 2022.
Prattling on. Yes, yeah. Today is a piece of history.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I also remember the AES had articles, and I think there was a bit of research. There was a research paper on using felt as well back in the 70s, coincidentally as well. Maybe.
Yeah, and different kinds of felts. Yeah, different kinds of felts, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so ended up amicably, so to speak.
Well, I'm not sure about amicably, but there was no process of being aggressive.
No, there was an understanding. I mean, that you, I guess in some ways, the understanding was that they knew that you had something on them, I suppose, and so it just. I mean, the reality was, I guess it was you and them, and you know, it wasn't like BMW had decided to do it, so to speak. you know, or someone selling 50,000 pairs of speakers a year is well, I don't know that VAF didn't sell 50,000 pairs of speakers a year, so I should retract that statement. But and I should also say that we are talking about VAF. So on the company you started, was it VAF something something, or was it just called VAF?
Well, it's still registered as VAF Research. I wanted it to be a research company. And that's what I did. We used to make a lot of things. We did the work for. We made products for other brands. We did some amazing things for things that were in, say, large venues. So the Adelaide Festival Centre we put 400 speakers in there. That wasn't about the noise. It was about actually optimizing the purity of sound in everyone's seat. And we weren't the only one. Well, sorry, we were. There was one company in the world doing that, but they chose us to do that with them. And then we did that in New York, in the largest church in New York, because they had a huge organ and they were getting down into, I think it was 12 deep. It was way down at very low frequencies. And the same thing, we were getting it down to well under a single, almost flat, absolutely flat.
So you
so it was nothing.
Yeah,
we did some interesting things.
Absolutely. So that whole multi-speaker thing. So was that a chair in everyone's seat kind of thing? What was? Tell us a little bit about the design of that. What? Because I'm thinking of something else. But when you say there were 400,
no, we had to put. So we put it was about 400. I think it started at 300 and something, and then they added another, I can't quite remember, 15 or 20 or something like that. So I think we nudged just over 400.
Yeah.
And we started with 380 something, I think.
Speakers.
And basically we looked at, they looked at, because it was an American company that did the work.
Yeah.
What they were doing was they were optimizing. What you hear is not just the direct sound from the speakers. You also hear the reflections from the rooms.
Yeah.
And it's a big room. Anything under about 2 milliseconds, our brain doesn't know what to do. It blends the sound together with the direct sound.
Sure.
If it's beyond 2 milliseconds, then our brain goes, I figured that out.
Yes.
So
yes.
You, all of us, any audio guy knows that there are some rooms that sound fantastic and other rooms that sound crap. And a lot of that is getting the time domain sorted, which very few people do it well, and the reflection the sound around the room at different frequencies as well.
Mm.
Sounds complicated, but it actually isn't that complicated. It's just difficult to understand.
Oh yeah, I think acoustics, full stop, is there's an expression that starts with the word head and finishes with a different word, and so you'd say it's easy, but is that because you've tackled some difficult jobs and you've gained an understanding and a comfort with solving the problems? Because I'm not sure that most people would say that acoustics is easy. So you're finding it easy. But this the 300-odd, 400 speakers, where were they placed? What? How did that work? March Audio. State-of-the-art Purify Audio amplifiers and loudspeakers. A pure pleasure to listen to. A sense of pride to own. March Audio. Excellence in audio.
The walls and the ceiling of the centre.
Okay, rightio.
And they were positioned fairly carefully with regards to the position of every seat. So even though they were a long distance from the people, they wanted to standardise that. Each of those had an input. That was a different input.
Yeah.
And we also had to have the crossovers in a particular way so that we could get the again, it was a time domain issue. It wasn't not just a flat line kind of thing.
Well, no, you haven't got 400 speakers connected up in series parallel. You've clearly got them delayed, I guess.
That one source. Each speaker had a source.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So they're all active, effectively. Is that what you're saying?
They all had input individually.
Wow. Okay. So we had a separate passive filtering then.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So that's a hell of a complex arrangement, isn't it? I mean, so some smart cookies worked all that out.
Yeah, but when you're young, it's fun. So, you know, the industry is kind of, there's a lot of people that love the industry. And, you know, I know you guys love the industry. So, and I know there's quite a few people around the world that love the industry. And yes, there's businesses as well, which is, you know, you've got to make money to cut, to staff the, to have a staff. But if you don't want to, if you're not fun, if you're not doing fun, I don't understand why people in the industry.
Well,
because the high end audio stuff, it's a small industry. I think it was in seven figures. It wasn't, it wasn't like, Sony putting in, hundreds of millions. And so,
no.
We were doing okay, but it was because of the fun we would do. I just could not do it.
No. I mean, and when you say fun, you mean to some degree just the challenge of designing this thing and getting it to sort of facilitating and getting it to work. That's that.
Curiosity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was almost in your 20s, was it, or early 30s that you pulled this off?
Well, I was born in 1960, and the company, I started making speakers when I was 15 years old. I did not know that I needed to be a company. Yeah. And so I didn't bother because I didn't know I had to. But then I was told that I needed to set up a business, and that was January 78.
Okay.
Then I was 17, the later part of 17.
Yeah, okay.
And the first speakers that went into a retail business was that year.
Wow.
And I was making speakers to a retailer that was well respected. Okay. And the boss said, these are what was his exact words? The thing is that it was about the price and the performance, and I didn't realize that I should have charged more because I was very young.
Well, you were working at building them for $2 an hour, obviously. So your value for money was very high, but obviously they performed well. Otherwise, there'd be no point them being cheap. You still can't, you can't sell a cheap, poor sounding speaker. Mainly because there's too many good, cheap, good sounding speakers. But so that's mightily impressive.
That's actually, dare I use the word, I don't think I've heard the word phenomenal used for a while.
From the 17, 18 years of age and obviously building speakers, I guess, the cabinets were being built in the back shed, or what was happening there?
Started off in a shed that my brother was building a boat in.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it was going to be sailing all around the world.
Like all boats being built in a shed?
Yep, and of course my brother is a very technically minded person because the design of the boat was designed by himself.
Okay.
To be able to be ice in the southern part of the world.
Wow.
Or the northern.
Okay.
And for 2 years. Okay. And it could have the body heat of two people with a 20% with a 20-degree temperature differential, and it could never tip over, and a whole bunch of things.
So
I was the slave. Me and my other brother were the slave labor.
Oh, okay. So he was he a? I mean, clearly he was a boat builder, but he didn't start off as a boat builder. He just had an idea. Is that so? This stuff runs in the family, obviously.
It's our dad that was the one that helped us. Dad was a very high level defense guy, and we didn't know that until we were much older. He didn't tell us about that.
The plot thickens.
But he taught us a lot.
Well, clearly,
you know, we're building an EDM. You know what an EDM machine is? You know, how do you cut really hard metals and we made an EDM machine, and okay. we didn't have huge capacitors because they would have cost a fortune back then. We just put a thousand volt light bulbs, and we were making cutting through some of the strongest metal in the world with tiny little bits of very fine wire, and
right.
So we could actually make things that normally those machines would have been impossibly expensive, but he taught us how to make things.
And, okay.
That's kind of that's the family. I didn't understand. We traveled a lot. He was a pilot. We traveled a lot. So we didn't end up having – I didn't have a lot of friends because every year we were moving.
Yeah.
But we learned how to make things. I just assumed everybody makes things. You know, when the family cars needed to be repaired, we didn't take it anywhere. We just fixed it.
Yeah, of course you did.
And my mother didn't complain when I put a fiberglass sheet on the dining table because I was making some flexible parts. Put a piece of plastic down.
Oh, you actually laid it up on the dining room table. You got the resin out.
Yeah.
Crikey. Yeah, all right. This house smells of resin for some reason.
In that bedroom, my two brothers and me, we had a metal lathe in the bedroom.
This is just getting better and better. Okay.
You had to be tidy, didn't you? You did clean up after you sorted the lathe.
Oh, we're careful, but I've got to say, I really enjoyed that. we could actually make things. Yeah, it was good fun. Yeah.
I think.
And Phil, was your? Now we've spoken before, but your dad did he fly Spitfires? Was that back in the day? May I ask that question? Well, I've asked the question, so.
Back at the beginning of the Cold War. This is something that I don't talk too much publicly. I don't think I've ever talked publicly about this.
Oh, okay. But Dad's
passed away a bit of a decade ago. But he was at the beginning of the Cold War, and he was teaching the Brits how to fly properly at low level. And even though they thought they knew how to fly, they didn't know how to fly low. And he's the guy that taught them how to do that. They used to have these ridiculously large cameras for 3D imaging back in the 50s, which is something that nobody understood back then. And he became he was the highest ranking Air Force officer. He was a guy that government he talked to, not the other people underneath him. And he became a bit of a hero, so that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
And that's why he understood how to organize things, how to do things that are very difficult, how to help us, he was designing a trimaran.
Wow.
He asked me to model up the I was 10 years old or something, and he was asking me how to he wanted me to draw the structure of it, and I said, but I don't know how to do it. And he said, well, it's just here are the formulas, just do that, don't worry about anything else.
Okay.
In other words, he was teaching us to do one thing at a time, and that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Very good teacher.
Yeah.
When you said he was teaching you how to do things, I was thinking things like what? How to winch a lathe into a bedroom through the window or something like that. I mean, how big a lathe?
Well, I think we had to put it there because the garage was full.
Yeah. Sorry, boys, I'm just turning your room into a metal turning space. Oh, that's great. And so the Antarctic exploration spec yacht that your brother was – I assume it was a yacht, as in it had sails. That got launched at some point, I take
it? Yeah, it did. It got launched and was in the water. And I hate to say this and I'm going to embarrass my brother, but he found a girl.
Okay,
And wanted to get married, and she'd prefer a house, so he said, okay, I'll sell the boat.
Aww.
And I'm going...
All boat stories end that way.
We spent years, and I felt like he stole our boat. It felt like a bit was mine.
Yeah, of course.
What, So timber boat, obviously, and what...
No, it was steel. The propellers had propellers that can change their dynamics. This was something that was early stage stuff that wasn't popular back then. And then we had Yes, we did have sales and all of that. The boat could be it would never go back under, and you know, it wouldn't go under. It would always right itself.
Yeah.
Everything was sealed.
Yep.
The little pipes where we can get fresh air in. This was way back at the beginning where there weren't too many, maybe none others. So if the boat does rotate, water wouldn't get in.
Yep.
Things like that. The kitchen was using the same fuel in the boat, but it was sealed in so that we could get the kitchen hot, but the gas would be going outside.
Yeah,
things like that. We really optimized. He is a very smart guy.
Yeah. Well, you need that for the Southern Ocean. You're going to need both heating, and you're going to need the ability for the thing to get rolled over, because you're bound to strike horrible weather, because it's horrible half the time, I think. And, so he never really went, annoyingly, you're ruining the story, Phil, so he never went too far in the vessel. He sold it for a lady, or a house, really.
He sold it for his wife, yes. Yeah. And then he built the house,
yeah,
which is something that is not that common. Or he got a few tradies, but he did a fair bit of the work.
Yeah.
And
it didn't look like a ship or a yacht, did it?
Oh, that's another story. It's an interesting life, and the VASH stuff was fantastic. I never treated it like a company. I never did. I treated it like it was a playground, and everything else I've done, I've treated like a company. But VASH, I still to this day don't treat it like a company. When Simon Hackett lovely guy, and anyone that understands the internet knows who he is, and he decided to ask if he could buy the company, and I said no. And I'd known him for a while, and we agreed, so I could be free. So I still own a chunk, but his team took some measure, and it freed me to do other things as well.
Yeah.
So, but till this day, I don't treat it like a company. I just like making audio stuff. The sound wall that I designed in my house here, I've got 7 sound walls. If anyone doesn't know what the sound walls are, look at the VAF website and have a look. But Parliament House Canberra has those things. They're flat panels, and I love them. Everyone that walks in, my wife's happy because it doesn't look like there's audio equipment anywhere, but you know, I can shake the walls still with problems.
Yep.
And our theater room here, I've got the main projection screen is sound walls. That's the sides either side. Nobody realizes when you walk in that they look like they're not the same thing, because you can make them look different in different ways. I print thing over here. I print something else over there. And people just assume it's artwork, but it's not. It's audio stuff and acoustic treatments and things like that. So that absolutely love it.
So the
signature 93s, the 66 and the 93s sound a little better.
Yeah.
The sound walls is something they're kind of like you want to put them in every room. Whereas the sound wall and the signature stuff is for the hardcore music lovers where
music listening room only. The Parliament House connection, so the sound wall and the Parliament House, Australian Parliament House in Canberra, the new one, obviously, that's the paging system in Parliament House, or what are the...
No, they asked a bunch of companies to put some products in there so they could check. And it wasn't about price. It wasn't about bass or anything. It was about human speech. What they said to us is that this is about human speech, and make sure that we can hear it so that we're not making mistakes, because the ministers have to make decisions. And so they wanted the things that sounded the most realistic to a human voice.
Okay.
And I don't know what other brands they bought, but there were quite a few. It wasn't just one.
Yeah.
And then once they tested them all, they chose ours.
Yeah, you've got to be happy with that, right?
Well, I'm recording when I say recording, I'm remembering what they said that they wanted. And yeah, we were proud of that because they were looking for a human voice and not a sound that they prefer, but an accuracy that they prefer.
Speech intelligibility as well.
Well, I guess intelligibility comes with accuracy of reproduction. Is that what you'd say, Phil?
Elements, yes. Comes back to time domain again. And yep. Look at the work that our new staff member came in a year or so ago looking at pushing the time domain a little bit further. So I was proud of the work I did with the original stuff. And we were right at the front of the world. You're probably aware of what Rolling Stone magazine did for us in terms of saying we're the ultimate in high fidelity performance with the best pace in the world. And we were not putting advertisements in them. They just decided to pick us as the best there is. And so that wasn't a begging us to do it. It was they decided to say something nice. And that was a surprise, a really big surprise. Now, over 20 years ago, you've probably seen the new reviews, and I'm really proud of the fact that the new guys that we've got that doing the work, and it's the foundation. It's a step above the foundation that I created, so I'm really proud that the guys are taking another step.
Baton's been handed on. Sorry,
baton. Yeah, well, it's kind of. I hope I'm never going to stop, but yes, you've got to let the people. You've got to let the guys go down their path. They've got to extend the stuff that you know what we did before, and you know, put another layer on top of that.
Yeah.
You certainly my listening experience at the recent, relatively recent Melbourne International Hi-Fi Show was that the product sounds fantastic. I heard the little coaxial model, which is a delight, and then the very large Monster, which I think is a new version of something that you developed some years ago, Phil, that large, because it's, you know, it's the, some would say the Duntech style speaker.
It was a flagship.
Yeah. And
it was our flagship, yes.
It's a surprisingly affordable loudspeaker for something of that scale, and the scale of the sound and the cleanliness and the realism is impressive. And I can say that because I don't make a loudspeaker in that size and price range, and neither does Brad. So we can pile on with the praise, and it's not affecting us. But genuinely, in fact, I tell you, when I was in your room, there was a well-known other South Australian loudspeaker designer/manufacturer of some size sitting in front of me, and also singing the praises of the sound. And on that subject, what the hell is it with South Australia and speakers? Do you want to throw some light on that?
Well, I've got to say that I think Crix and me are the oldest ones in the game. I could be wrong, but I don't think anybody's been running, you know, around 50 years. And I was fortunate that I started as a very young person. And I've got to say, I like Crix's work. I remember when his son was born and my daughter was born. It was 2 weeks apart from each other.
Oh, well, is that right? Okay.
Before he had all that wonderful equipment, we had a shed, what looked like a farm sort of area.
Yeah.
And it was on the other side of the city. It was about a 45-minute drive from where I lived. Yeah. But I decided to drive down and I asked him whether it was possible for us to make a speaker together, and he looked at me really weird. But so his product is different to our product. It wasn't competitive. I really, really am happy for them to have succeeded.
Because it wasn't
the same stuff.
No, it's not
the same stuff.
No, it's quite.
They do
quite
a lot of the theatre work. They've done a lot of, you know, they're doing some really interesting stuff, and out of all of Australia, I'm really proud of what we're doing at BAF, and I'm also proud of what they're doing.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, it's Crix is completely impressive. Clearly the most successful
Australian manufacturer of loudspeakers from the point of view of probably just the range of products. And I feel like with their overseas sales, they seem to be sending them all around the world now, with pretty significant sales happening in Europe, I think, which is kind of amazing and completely impressive, although I guess more in the home cinema realm. But their cinema wall that fits behind a acoustically transparent screen is it's a very Australian looking product. It's pretty, you know, bold looking and impressive, and sounds impressive. So Scott seems like the actually the nicest guy, and it's I meant what I said about the South Australian thing, because of course your fellow user of felt around drivers at Mr. Dunlavy. I mean, I know he's American, but for some reason he set up shop in Adelaide. And vaguely I'm thinking that was something to do with some local government tax incentives or something, although that's probably not why you and Scott got started. But is that why he ended up there? Do you remember, or does it even matter?
Yeah, that's what he and his wife told me.
Yeah, okay.
It was about optimizing the profitability of the company.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but there's been a few other brands over the years.
There's a few.
Yep. So whereas Queensland, for instance, where I'm from, absolutely nothing really. It's been very, very few. Sydney would appear to be the other hub of speaker building activity. Obviously,
there's Michael Linehan and yourself, as far as I remember.
Yeah. But we built speakers quietly, and we hardly ever went. We every now and again, maybe I'll rephrase that. On three occasions, we explored going through retail, but we didn't really.
I was going to ask you about that. Yes.
The only one is about Rad in Melbourne. He's such a nice guy, good family and stuff. And he asked me about it, and I said okay, because I really like the guy. It wasn't that complicated.
No, Rab's a charmer. There's no doubt about that. Yeah.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, and it's a good arrangement. So anyone in Melbourne is going to see Rab speakers. They're not a problem, but we don't have them anywhere else, and we've never had. You know, we never. Like I said at the beginning, when the business was really moving forward, it was kind of crazy because most of our sales were not in Adelaide. They were all over the place, people would come in. This is when we used to remember before we had these phones that we're using right now. We had magazines, and then there'd be a little thing that you cut off on the magazine, and you put your credit card details on, and you put it in the mail, and that started coming. Electronics Australia we did a lot of work with them because I don't know why they chose us, because I think it was just because I liked them, I guess. But we're on the cover. We're on the cover a lot of times. And,
I can remember that. Annoyingly, yeah. I remember that. It was. I mean, your marketing was exceptional.
It wasn't marketing. It was. I was supposed to be making a product for one of the electronics stores.
Yeah.
And Woolworths was buying the company, and every 6 months the key staff would be moved into a different position. And the cover for the January edition was getting close and close and close and close, and it looked like the magazine was going to miss out on, you know, something decent. And I picked up the phone and I said, "How about we do?" And also the folks that we were doing the other work for, and I said, "How about we do this? How about I'll take the run on this on developing a high quality kit and not kit stuff, and we'll try to build the industry a bit more."
Sure.
And they said, "Yeah, let's do that." And so we got a 12 page for the first DC range, the three models of the DC range, and that kicked off. That really, really kicked off hard. We were making them in many hundreds of at a time. That was just me guessing. I said, okay, if we don't succeed, we'll have all the product and we can sell it through the following year.
Yeah.
But if we do, then we people don't have to wait. They can order it. It'll come in. The day that the letter comes in, I tell the staff that we want to be shipping it out the same day.
Wow. Yeah, that's how to run a business. Yeah.
Yeah, and that worked. And that's how it started. And then the other electronics magazines were putting other things about what we were doing, and that became other stories around different kinds of technologies and this and that. And we ended up with the majority of our speakers being sold to technically minded people that love music and or the sound of music.
Well, there was a twist to that, though, wasn't there, Phil? And that is that you kind of offered them as some kind of kit version as well, as I remember it.
Well, that's because when I was young, and I liked the kits because I wanted to know how to learn how to make things.
Yeah.
And I just assumed that most tech guys would prefer to make it rather than buy it.
Yeah.
And then I realized that some of them just want to buy it.
Yeah, that's right. Is there a ratio? What do you think? Was it 50-50 or?
Look, the truth is, I'm going to tell you the truth. The
cost, please do.
It actually cost us more to package the kits
to make
the speaker because the speaker fits into a simple box, whereas the cabinet still has to go in a box.
Yes, and then you got all the drivers.
All the other parts have to go. Yes, so there's more product to ship, the cost, and so on. So I just wanted to make sure that I just want to make sure the people that were buying the product is what they wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
And And then we did the free returns. And I think to this day we still do it. If anyone buys anything and doesn't like it in 30 days, they can ship it back. And
you might have been an early pioneer on that front as well. I mean, some say there are new ideas under the sun, but you did this 30 years ago.
Yeah, but I did it right up to when I took when I sold a chunk of the business.
And,
not all of it, but a chunk of it.
Yep.
And out of all of those years, all of those many, many years, decades, we only got 5 returns.
Wow.
And four of them was great DC series. They're fantastic, better than I thought. Can we get some signatures instead?
Yeah, okay, all right. Yep.
So out of the 5 returns, there was only 1 actual return.
That's
the rest was loving it and wanted to buy it.
Yeah, impressive. Yeah, excellent. I love this whole story. I guess from someone who wasn't in Adelaide or South Australia, and someone who was in hi-fi retailing, VAF was kind of a pain in the ass because, and I mean that in the nicest possible way, because the product was clearly good. Customers would come into the store and tell you, oh, yeah, I've got a pair of VAFs. They're really good. And you're like, yeah, okay. Well, what do I do with that? Because you had set yourself up intentionally otherwise kind of outside the industry, and you've already said that you didn't really see yourself to some degree as in the audio business. Well, there's 100 stores in Australia at the time that you were not supplying, and yet you were doing very nicely selling them direct and creating a bunch of customers who would come in and tell us how good they are. And I did trade a few pairs in over the year, and I'm like, you know, they are kind of good. That's really annoying. Because I mean, that
there was a lovely guy that passed away a few years ago in the audio game. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of shops down the east coast of Australia. Mm-hmm. They had Sydney, Melbourne, up in Queensland. They had quite a few stores along the edge.
Yeah.
And his salespeople flew in to talk to me and said, Philip, we'd like you to consider selling to us.
Yes.
Because we'll be able to make you more money. Yes, you'll get a less percentage of the money because obviously we've got to take a percentage in there. But because we sell so many more speakers, you'll do the math and you'll be better off.
Yes. Yeah,
and I said, well, let's have a discussion. Can you come in and tell me exactly what the numbers are and stuff? Came back about 2 months later and said, this is what we'd like to achieve. And I said, we're already selling more speakers than that. And he looked at me and went, Oh, I'm not kidding. That actually happened. And that was the number that they thought that I was doing. We're actually selling more speakers than they were.
Yeah, they had an idea that you would be selling X amount, but they'd underestimated that amount dramatically, obviously, and therefore their numbers were, of no relevance to you. So, Hey, thank you, Phil. Phil Vafiadis, the founder of VAF, or VAF, you call it VAF Research. Clearly, it's a shortening of your name. And a business still going strong in Adelaide, making, designing and manufacturing loudspeakers and selling them, and a bit of hi-fi gear as well. In the centre of speaker manufacturing in Australia, which is Adelaide.
The hub,
yes. Annoyingly. And thank you, Brad. Thank you for chiming in and asking some interesting questions as well. But thank you, Phil, for your time. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Hey Now Hi-Fi specializes in creating personalized audio experiences with brands to suit all needs and over three decades of experience. Jeff from Hey Now Hi-Fi can help find your sound for your life. Have a look at the website now. Not right now. You're listening to the podcast. Later, but soon.
We're here again at the Sydney 2025 Hi-Fi Show with Nick Italiotis. Greek
background.
Yeah. But I mean, you're probably born in Australia, I would imagine. Not yes. That it even matters. I don't know why we're talking about it. Let's just let's talk about hi-fi. I mean, you do look Greek.
A little bit. You're the first person that I've met in a long time that can actually pronounce it the right way in the first go.
I speak a small amount of Italian, but that's nothing to do with it. And when I say I speak it, I really can't remember any of it, but I guess I've thought about pronunciation. But no, I'm monolingual, really. But do you speak any Greek, though?
Do speak some at home. Have spoken some, you know, growing up with the parents and... But my kids, unfortunately, don't speak it very well.
Yeah, okay. Which is, one day they're going to regret because they're going to want to go on a holiday.
Yeah, they will.
And painlessly order food and
yes.
book a hotel and drive
yeah,
a rental
that's
car.
Right,
but
anyhow,
I'll have a conversation with your long lost relatives.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So you are the relatively new designer, acoustic engineer at VAF.
Yes.
Is it VAF, like research or VAF?
VAF Research.
VAF Research.
Yeah.
Which is a very old, really, in Australian loudspeaker manufacturing terms, Australian loudspeaker manufacturer. I mean, been around since the...
1978, I believe.
78, yeah. And we have interviewed Philip Vafiadis.
Yes.
Sounds a bit Greek.
That's purely coincidence, trust me.
Yeah. And we have, we've been meaning to, Phil gave us a very interesting interview, and we are editing it shortly, and we'll probably combine it with what we're speaking to you about now.
Okay.
And he will probably be on first, so he will have told us how old the company is. It's not really your concern, though, because
yes.
You've been brought on as to revitalise the range, or what was the... I mean, I know you told me once you answered an ad.
Yes.
Yes.
It's actually very... I'm very lucky to actually get the job at VAF because, you know, throughout my journey, I've loved sound since I was 5 years old, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember... my dad's stereo and how it was like, you know, a revelation every time I turned it on, you know.
Yeah.
And I loved it from a very young age, hi-fi and sound and music, and remember the old days of recording cassettes and playing records on a turntable and things
Absolutely.
Like that. And throughout my teens, you know, collected, you know, various bits of audio equipment, eventually decided to study audiovisual technology at RMIT.
Yeah, okay.
And I had one of the professors there that was, you know, teaching us audio technology. He was a speaker man, you know, and
okay.
And we got talking, and
yeah.
He introduced me to the technical aspects of speaker design then.
Yes.
You know, Theobald Small and all the theory, and I started, you know, downloading, you know, in. Stuff over the years, and at the time there was not much in terms of you know, what you could get. There was no internet, so we used to go to the library and look at the documents from the Audio Engineering Society, and
yeah.
that's where I sort of started with the theory, and, you know, first started with building subwoofers and you know, tuning boxes and all the alignments and all that sort of stuff, and progressed more and more into loudspeaker design alongside other things that I've been doing, because I could never really get a job as a loudspeaker designer.
Well, no, I mean, and that's kind of why I mentioned the fact that you answered the ad. I mean, it must have been to some degree a dream come true. I mean, like, I've got this interest,
it was,
and I've got the skills.
It was.
But no, I mean, really, there's not, I mean, particularly in the last, I guess, 20 years in Australia, not a hell of a lot of, volume of loudspeaker manufacturing going on. And if there is, it's always in South Australia, though, for some reason, which is conveniently, although you didn't live in South Australia, as I remember it. No. But you do now, clearly, unless you're doing a long commute every day. But, I don't know what it is with South Australian speakers. But the point is, there was a bit of a lull in the industry, and I guess it's stepped up a little bit lately in the last few years, sort of post-COVID, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so you see this ad, you've got these skills, you've got the interest, and then you applied, and here we are.
It's a funny story, Andrew. I saw this ad, and I'm like, is this even possible for me to get this job? I mean, I've got experience, like real life experience, not as a professional designer, but as I've got the audio engineering background, but as a hobbyist, really. Some experience and a lot of tools. A little bit of experience with measurement and simulation stuff that I've been collecting and working with over the years and building various stuff. And then I thought, maybe they'll have a look at what I've made in the past and give me a crack at it, And that's the genuine truth. Like, I just applied for the job, and I spoke to the then designer, Marty Jones.
Okay.
And Marty was kind enough to hand over my details to the recruiting HR manager.
Yeah, yeah.
And they gave me a call for an interview, and went in for the interview, and a few weeks later, another interview, and then another interview, and
is that right? Okay.
Yeah, so it took a few goes.
So they
weren't
making a quick decision.
No, it took a little bit of time because they were interviewing a few people.
Yeah.
Some already in the industry.
Yes.
And eventually, they rang me up and said, "Okay, let's go for coffee and have a chat."
Okay.
And I thought all my Christmases came at once, mate. So I was so humbled by it, and I feel so lucky to this day to get a job doing what I love doing, that I've pretty much dropped everything else I've been doing up until now.
Yeah, okay.
Business going in the background, still there, managed by family mainly.
Yes.
So I can do what I love doing.
Yeah, yeah. And so are you there 5 days a week, or what's, I mean?
I'm there full time at the moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm obviously, sometimes I have to take, a little bit of time out to address other, other interests and business ventures. But
I guess it's not like they're designing. I'm the listener to the podcast probably doesn't realise actually how long, even in a relatively small loudspeaker manufacturing enterprise such as VAF, how long you might actually spend developing a model. I mean, there's an enormous amount of effort that goes into it. I mean, because really, you can't, there's no shortcuts, because your competition is spending an enormous amount of effort.
That's right.
So you're probably going to have to do the same.
That's right.
And, so is there, could you illuminate us a little bit as to how long you might spend from discussion of a concept for a new model to the research of how you're going to go about doing it, and then ultimately the design and the fine tuning, etc.?
Can do that. I can give you an insight. I haven't actually designed anything from scratch yet.
Yeah, because you've kind of been taking what was there and improving it.
Refining it, or improving it, latest iteration, the i93 Mark V.
Yep.
I sort of got thrown in the deep end.
Yes.
Because they hired me and I guess they probably didn't really know what I could do.
Yeah.
So they were a little bit careful with what they wanted me to give you something to attack.
Something supposedly easy initially. Yep, yep.
So over the Christmas, New Year's break, was just around about the time I started.
Yeah.
I didn't have a whole lot to do, so I wanted to do a little bit of tweaking, you know, sure. because, you know, starting in a loudspeaker, you know, company, you want to start, you know, designing something and, you know.
Get your teeth into it.
Yeah, that's right. And every designer knows it's how exciting it is. So I thought I'd try and improve one of the current models, the i91 SE, which I did some measurements, did some listening and thought maybe we can try something with that.
Sure.
Did the simulations, the testing and worked out that, hey, you know what, there's a little bit of room for improvement here. Let's have a go, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be accepted as a design, but I'm not going to sit around and do nothing. So
no.
Let's have a crack at doing what I'm here to do.
Yes.
And it turns out that the change that I made was well accepted.
Yeah, okay.
You know, they liked it, so we implemented it.
Okay.
And then it's like, okay, well, let's, you know, do the latest iteration of the O93 because we're in the middle of a model change due to the fact that we couldn't get the same drivers anymore from Cs that...
I guess people, I mean, many people listening realise, but that's kind of how it works, is that the reality is that if you can't get some of your parts anymore, it could be any kind of part, then that is the driver perhaps for a revision or a Mark III or a 5 or whatever. That's the realities. And so the 93 is the super tall one, right?
The 93 is the big boy.
Yep.
And what originally started as, okay, well, let's try and integrate these new base drivers in the design and tweak the crossover. And then I thought, okay, well, let's change the baffle a little bit because I don't like, you know, this aspect or that aspect of it.
Yeah.
Being as we're going to go to a new iteration, why don't we make a few more changes? And so we've
So you go down a rabbit hole. Where do you stop?
You're opening a can of worms.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, now this is going to need a whole new crossover change because we've changed the profile of the front baffle.
Yes.
So, you know, all other aspects of the sound are going to change. So we've got to redesign the crossover now.
And when you say redesign, I mean, clearly there's a tweaking of it, but have you changed the base, the kind of the style of crossover in the sense of it was whatever the slopes were, have you gone to different slopes or different shaped curves or alignments as such?
Good question. I designed it from the ground up and I just used the slopes that I thought worked best for those drivers, which are shallow slopes.
Okay.
So we're not using a very aggressive, high order crossover in that. They're shallow slopes. It's kind of like a hybrid between first and second order.
Okay. Yep.
To get, you know, phase matching across frequency, crossover range and that. And I just did what I thought would work best for magnesium alloy drivers.
I mean, this is how it works, isn't it? You look at what your materials are doing and breakup modes and things and how you're going to deal with that.
Yes.
And so does it end up being in the case of, because this is a, how many driver, you've got?
Five driver.
Yeah, I was going to say five, yeah. So it's a three-way, I guess. A sort of Diapolito arrangement.
Yep.
And with a stepped baffle, sort of some sort of quasi-time aligned sort of thing or?
Yes, we've got time alignment on all bands. So we've got the mid-range and the tweeter is set back from the woofers to get the physical time alignment acoustic centres in the same vertical plane. And then there's obviously the phase alignment in the crossover for the timing.
And shallow slopes, is there much other sort of filtering, like as other... conjugates and things like that, or is it? Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So it's quite a complex crossover in the end.
It's taken about 9 months of development just on the crossover.
Yeah, to come back to our timeline. So you've spent 9 months on the crossover.
9 months on the crossover. There is a lot of filtering going on, as in there's notch filtering in there. There's conjugates in there. You know, impedance leveling filters to make the notch filters work.
Yes. Yeah.
And being a hard material such as magnesium alloy, you got to be very precise with where you apply those filters at the various breakup modes, especially in the critical mid-range and tweeter. And so it was a redesign because the drivers, are not the same. and they also vary from batch to batch.
Yeah. So, yes. How much? I mean, that's, I mean, I would not a lot. Say as I thought would be very consistent, but not as consistent as you would like.
Not always as consistent as we would like.
Yeah.
Especially when you're dealing with those very sharp breakup
yeah.
modes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So they couple do of move, they move around a bit.
Yeah, a couple of hundred hertz up or down.
Yeah. I guess they move around post running in as well, do they?
Or they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
They do.
Yeah.
You know, suspension needs to run in, voice call and the like.
Yes.
The likes need to loosen up and, you know, and break in.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And I've lost my train of thought.
That's okay. It happens. That
doesn't happen much.
It happens to me as well, mate.
It has been a long day. I'll come back to that point, whatever the hell it was.
We're talking about breakups.
Yeah, we're talking about breakup modes, but prior to that, I had a thought that we were talking about... I was going to say, I mean, what kind of... An insect just flew up my nose. As far as capacitive inductor... I know inductors you make your own.
Yep.
From, you know, premium Australian copper, presumably.
Yes, sir.
But capacitors and resistors, I mean, resistors not so much. I mean, although, do you have a preference in resistors? There's a certain person on the internet that seems to think that ceramic resistors, as we call them here, he calls them sandcast.
Sandcast.
no good?
Look, it can be good if it's implemented in the right way.
Yeah.
I think it's the synergy of parts that makes the speaker what it is, not always just the material. You can hear a very good speaker with a diamond tweed and it'll sound terrible.
Yes.
And you can hear a very good, you can hear an average speaker with a silk dom tweeter sounds fantastic.
Yes.
So Soundcast resistors, they got their place and applications.
Mm-hmm.
We like to use non-inductive.
Of course.
Non-inductive resistors. As you know, our inductors are hand wound in house.
Mm-hmm.
Capacitors, we like to use the SCR capacitors, French made.
Yep.
Usually, if we can get them. Otherwise equivalent.
Film capacitor kind of thing.
Yep. Yep.
Yep.
Film.
Pretty consistent performance.
Yeah.
Values. They're accurate.
Yeah. Usually they're around about, range from 1% to 5%.
Yes.
Is what we use, what we can get our hands on. It varies a little bit.
Do you batch them up? Do you sort of measure everything?
Yep. Yep. We, I do believe highly in matching components of that particular set.
Yep.
So starts with the, the process starts with measuring the drivers. And then when we're winding the coils for that particular set of speakers, we make sure that we match the filters to the particular breakup modes of those drivers.
Yeah, well,
once they're running.
So they're kind of, they're very much handcrafted. And the thought that I'd forgotten was that for the poor DIYer, the thought that you there's nothing wrong with DIYs, that's where I guess we all started. But the point is, you've spent 9 months developing a crossover. No one's sitting at home, or maybe some people are playing with their crossover for 9 months, but it's not worth it when you're only building one pair of speakers. Surely, I mean, this is where production, models, louds, produced by manufacturers in quantity.
Mm.
Where they start to make more sense financially, don't they? Because you're not spending 9 months of your time trying to fine-tune a crossover, assuming you've even got the skills to do that.
That's right.
I always, people do sometimes imply that these things happen quite quickly. They do not. I guess in your case, this 93 is a very complex design.
It is a complex
design. The
baffle's
design. Complex, the crossover's complex. Yes. So what redesign on that speaker took more than a year?
Took more than a year because we started from scratch. So new drivers in the bass section.
Yes.
New time alignment because we changed it a little bit due to the new drivers. Mm-hmm. The acoustic center was in a different place. I didn't sort of follow the same crossover and just do a couple of tweaks.
Mm.
I thought that it would be easier to start from scratch.
Clean sheet of paper
instead of trying to, change something that's, that's optimized for something else. And that's how the story started. And months and months of tweaking, listening, tuning, and trying a lot of different iterations of the crossover, as you know.
I mean, the reality is that some things just, they might measure similarly, but they sound different. And some, whoop, we've lost your mic.
Oh, sorry.
And some are more enjoyable than others.
Yes, and what measures good doesn't always necessarily sound good.
No. There is loudspeaker design really is a black art, even though a lot of people are trying to say it's not anymore.
It is.
Due to computer power or, you know, simulation, etc. But you can simulate till the cows come home, you still don't know. You're not simulating how it's going to sound, though. You're only simulating how it's going to measure.
I think it's very rare to simulate something on the first go, put it together and listen to it and say, wow, that sounds amazing.
Oh, I think it's almost always the opposite, isn't it?
It is.
Sometimes you go, I had high hopes for this.
Yes.
It's simulated beautifully.
Yes. Yeah, it looks great.
And it actually measures very similar to the simulation.
Yeah.
But
it just doesn't sound right.
No.
And that's when you're really starting to get stuck into the art of crossover design, where you're playing around with the slopes, you're playing around with the directivity. Yeah. You're playing around with the, with the filtering to get a desired phase response, or to make the sound coherent and natural.
Yeah. No, it's so. Is there any? It's the first time you've worked as a designer in loudspeakers. Is there anything that you thought would be a particular way, but it's turned out to be not that way? And I don't know what really I mean by that, other than you had expectations, I guess. Were they met, or is it just? I don't know. For instance, we've just talked about how long it took to get a result. Did you? I mean, you obviously designed your own loudspeakers for your own personal purposes, but I don't know. Did it turn out to be more challenging than you expected, or was it in fact
No.
I mean, clearly, it wasn't easier.
It wasn't easy. Definitely wasn't easy.
Mm.
The result didn't come easily, that's for sure.
No.
Now, I expected it to be tough.
Yeah.
And it was hard.
Mm.
Because as well, the drivers being made out of magnesium alloy, there's those challenges that come with that material.
And magnesium, is that a philosophical choice at VAF due to some characteristic that they produce?
They have been used in VAF speakers for quite some time.
Yeah.
We've been using magnesium alloy mid-ranges for quite a few years, down to the very beginning, I think. And then they went with the magnesium alloy tweeter, and now finally the Papercone woofers that were no longer available. Naturally, we thought, instead of changing all the drivers to a completely different material, let's just make get the matching bass driver.
So bass units, mag as well.
Magnesium alloy.
Now I have to say, having heard this loudspeaker, and I assume that I heard it in its current finalised form at Melbourne last year. If magnesium conjures thoughts of a certain kind of sound, but that's not the way that loudspeaker sounds. And when I say a certain kind of sound, I guess you know what I mean.
Yes.
A somewhat sort of resonant, metallic-y, bright, nasty.
Yes.
But it does not sound like it's sweet and lovely, isn't it?
Oh, thanks you, Andrew. I really appreciate that
comment. Well, it is though, isn't it?
Really appreciate that comment.
It's got a real sort of space and sort of... Yeah. It's just a delight. And it's quite quite detailed.
Yeah.
But there's a real realism to it. And I remember... being sadly for me, as you're effectively the opposition in some ways, been mightily impressed.
That's fantastic.
But we're not really the opposition. I think everyone's speakers are slightly different. They appeal to a different audience, and your price points, etc., are probably somewhat different. And the reality is that we don't sell a lot of speakers, and you sell tons of the things, don't you?
I think so. we sell enough.
Australian loudspeaker, designed here, made here, and it sounds absolutely world class.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew.
No, it's a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
The truth.
Yeah, thanks,
it's what we do here at the Not an Audiophile podcast.
Thank you very much.
Hey, well, thanks for speaking to us, Nick.
You're welcome.
Continue to have a great show. You're obviously poking around and checking stuff out.
Yeah, I'm having a bit of a listen. I have to say, I don't know if you want to put this in or not, I love the sound of your speakers, mate.
Oh, thank you.
They sound fantastic.
I will put that in.
they do sound absolutely incredible. And as I was saying to you before, The sound of that jazz recording you played last time at the Melbourne Hi-Fi show, I quite enjoyed it. It left a memorable impression.
No, oh, thank you.
For me, and I thought that...
that was actually on our entry-level product, wasn't it? Yeah.
For such a modest cabinet, it was producing an immense soundstage. It sounded so real. Depth of field was there. Just and that's the honest truth. It sounded great.
Thank you so much.
Loved it.
I appreciate your thoughts on that. And actually, that the 70S Nick's referring to, and it actually it sells okay. And you can sort of buy it as a kit if you want to, which is
incredible value.
Makes it super cheap.
Incredible value.
It is a product we only sell direct because it is kind of a kit, and it's not a fully it's not a veneered box or anything.
It's a grown up sound, Andrew.
I enjoy listening to them at home quite often, and so thank you. I appreciate ears passing over them. Now that we've finished the loudspeaker design, Australian loudspeaker designers self-congratulatory club meeting, we will say goodbye to each other, and we will close this episode. Well, not the episode, but this interview off. Thanks, Nick.
You're welcome. Thanks. It was an absolute pleasure, Norris.
Great. Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
An Australian loudspeaker legend has been born with the stunning new VAF Research i93 Mark V, winner of Stereonet's Floor Standing Loudspeaker Product of the Year and Sound and Image Magazine's Floor Standing Speaker of the Year, $20,000 to $50,000. VAF's i93 has redefined what I thought was possible from a loudspeaker in a domestic setting, says Stereonet. VAF Research, building award-winning loudspeakers in Australia since 1978.